What's up, everyone? This is Mike Cashew, and you're listening to the Brute Strength Podcast. This week's guest is Ryan Holiday, 29-year-old phenom that has already written 4 books and been the director of marketing at American Apparel. The reason that I reached out to Ryan in the first place was that his last few books have been getting a ton of popularity in the professional sport world. Professional NFL and MLB players, their coaches, and their entire organizations. When I asked him about this on the show, he said that it's probably because things like building strength and speed and technique are things that everyone already knows how to do. Everyone is doing them currently, practicing them. But what everyone is not yet doing is training their mind. And the topic of his last few books is on Stoic philosophy, which is basically the practice of changing your mind. So I hope that you get as much out of this show as I have, because it's completely his writing as well as other Stoic teachings has completely changed my life and the way that I perform. So without further ado, enjoy the show. What's up, everyone? This is Mike Cashew, and this is the Brute Strength Podcast. I'm here with Ryan Holiday, author, entrepreneur, all around great human being. Ryan, I said it before, but I'll say it again. I know you're an incredibly busy guy. You have a lot of irons in the fire, so I really appreciate you making time to do this with me.
No, thanks for having me, man. I always love talking about this stuff.
Awesome, man. So, you know, this first part might be, I know it will be a little bit repetitive for you. You talk about it all the time, but just for those who haven't had any experience with Stoic philosophy in any of your books, I want to start by kind of just defining what Stoic philosophy is. And my understanding is basically that it's more of a philosophy of action. There are different principles. There are a lot of principles that are similar to other branches of philosophy, but this one is very focused on action. Is there anything that you want to add to that definition?
Sure. So Stoic philosophy is a practical philosophy, right? When most people hear the word philosophy, they think some sort of pointless exercise in college. They think sort of provocative but ultimately pointless questions, right? Like, how do we know we're not living in a computer simulation? Or, you know, what is the, you know, do morals exist, right? All sorts of complicated questions that leave you with more questions than they provide answers. Stoicism is sort of the opposite of that in every way. It's a practical set of sort of exercises and sort of bits of wisdom that are supposed to help you live, right? It's famous with a number of really, really successful, powerful people. You have Marcus Aurelius, who's the emperor of Rome. You have Seneca, who's a political advisor and writer. You have Cato, who's the man who challenges Julius Caesar when Caesar makes himself emperor. And then even throughout American history, right? George Washington is a big fan of the Stoics. Thomas Jefferson dies with a copy of one of the Stoic philosophers on his nightstand. It's a philosophy designed, as I define it, to help you deal with the things that you don't control. So the Stoics would say you don't control what happens to you, you control how you respond. Stoicism is about that part, right? The response. What do you do when the thing you planned didn't turn out the way you planned? What do you do when someone does something to you that's completely unfair? What do you do when you're at your absolute limits as a human being? You know, Stoicism is sort of a way of acting and living and thinking that helps you deal with adversity and difficulty.
So why do you think this has taken, why do you think high performers, athletes, et cetera, have taken to Stoic philosophy so much over the past, I don't know, 5 to 10 years?
Well, I don't know if it goes back that far. I think when my first book came out, this is The Obstacle is the Way, what I was trying to do was take this sort of ancient philosophy that, although I think is very accessible, was somewhat intimidating to people because, again, they feel like philosophy doesn't help them. If you're a professional athlete or you coach professional sports, or you know you're a strength and conditioning instructor, it doesn't naturally follow that you should be studying a bunch of, you know, dead white guys from 2,000 years ago. Right. What I tried to do in The Obstacle is the Way is take the sort of the wisdom of Stoic philosophy and illustrate it in the form of stories and examples that I think apply in a business context. They apply in a personal development context. They apply just for anyone who's trying to deal with what's in front of them. So, my book was obviously a big part of it sort of spreading through sports. It was totally unexpected and very cool that it happened. But I think one of the reasons it resonates so much with people in the space that you're in is that a lot of the gains have already – a lot of the easy gains or the uncrowded trades, to use a finance term, in sort of raw physical strength, in play calling, in the actual sort of strategy of the game – a lot of those have already been found, right? Right. Some of these games are 100, 150 years old, and the smartest people, have been tackling them, where the most talented people have been tackling them. Where there hasn't been the same amount of focus is on the mental side of things, and sort of coming up with an attitude that's resilient to, let's say, defeat, coming up with an attitude that doesn't let victory go to your head, something that helps you deal with stress or fear. There's less experimentation there, and Stoicism is sort of exclusively about those things. And so Stoicism, in the way that I explained it, became very relevant to people who are looking for an edge in that department.
And it provides like an entire framework, not just like one tool such as imagery or mindfulness, but an entire framework for how to think and deal with all of the challenges of sport and business, etc.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I think anyone who's really interested in getting better at sport is probably also trying to get better at being a human being. And Stoicism isn't just about, it's not just a series of life hacks for being a better emperor. It's also about how to be a better person. And so I think these things all are all sort of related. They're similar pursuits, and the people that pursue them have similar interests.
Do you ever find that people, they only want the performance benefit and they shy away from looking at how it can affect their life, or are more resistant with allowing these things to change their, the other side of their life?
Of course, but I don't necessarily think that's a bad thing, because I think the Stoics were very pragmatic, and I don't think they would have a problem with why someone came to the philosophy, right? Mm-hmm. So and this is something, that has been controversial about my books, and I feel like I could argue this with a lot of conviction and talk about it all day. I don't have a problem with someone coming – like, so the criticism has been like Stoicism is this complicated moral philosophy and it's not a series of life hacks, which I would totally agree with. But by nature, the fact that this philosophy has been mostly ignored by people for the last 2,000 years, clearly presenting it as a moral philosophy as the entry point has not been as successful today as it once was. So if presenting the life hack elements of it, here, think this way when you get afraid, or think this way when you're dealing with stress, or this gives you a mental edge over your opponent. If that's what brings someone to Stoic philosophy, and then in exploring it, they find a number of other things, to me, that's all upside. And I don't have a problem with that. And I don't think the Stoics would have had a problem with that either. I think it's only people who are the only reason to be concerned with that is if you are focused on other people and not yourself. What matters is what you get out of the philosophy, right? Like, it doesn't bother me that a lot of people have a somewhat superficial understanding of, say, Zen Buddhism. Maybe they only go to yoga because that's where there's hot girls, or they think it makes them look spiritual and smart. Mm-hmm. It doesn't concern me that that's what other people are using this philosophy for, because I'm kind of too busy with my own life trying to go on my own journey to spend a lot of time criticizing how other people are doing it.
Right. I couldn't agree with that more. And that's very interesting. And I know you have a significant marketing background. Is that something that you thought about beforehand, before you wrote your books? Or is that just what you've noticed having looked back?
Well, I think it's essential that if you're sitting down to write a book, you actually think about who this is for and what you're trying to accomplish with it. I think to not think about that is not only less artistic, but it's stupid. Mm-hmm. So what I sat down when I first off, I've obviously read a lot about Stoicism. It's something I've been personally fascinated with, and I read all the books for my own sort of exploration first and foremost. And what I found repeatedly is that it's very hard to beat the Stoics, right? Like Seneca is an amazing, brilliant writer. Look, when he says something like anger always outlasts hurt, right? That's a brilliant insight that's lasted for 2,000 years. It's very hard for someone to write that better than how he wrote it, right? So when I was sitting down to write a book about Stoicism, what I'm not going to try to do is spend 20 paragraphs explaining what he means when he was able to do it in 5 or 6 words, right? And so when I said, I want to write a book about Stoicism, what I thought is, what is a unique angle that I can bring on this? What is value that I can add to the reader and to my own life, right? What is going to be exciting and interesting for me to do? So I wrote it in the form of stories, which I think illustrate various principles, bring a sort of Stoic philosophy to a very specific scenario, either overcoming obstacles, suppressing your own ego, whatever it happens to be. And so I absolutely am thinking about that. And I'm thinking about what is a way that's going to make this message the most accessible to the most amount of people. I don't think there's that much value in preaching to the choir. I want to reach new people and I want to have impact with new people. And I think the book's done that. Look, there's a reason the word Stoicism not only isn't in the title of The Obstacle is the Way, my first book on the topic, it only appears maybe like 3 or 4 times in the whole book. And I even say up front, like, it's not about Stoicism. This is not a book of Stoic philosophy. It's a book that uses Stoic philosophy. And so I think that's very important.
I love it, man. So in that book, there are 3 main sections: perception, action, and will. Can you briefly explain each of these, how they relate to Stoicism, and how we can use those principles?
Well, so Stoicism is 3 distinct disciplines. The first discipline is the discipline of perception. That's how you look at the world. That's how you see what's in front of you. That's being objective. That's sort of being clear-headed. That's seeing the good in every situation versus the bad, you know, a number of these things. And then the discipline of action, of course, is what do you do with these perceptions, right? How do you then go out in the world and do the right thing in the right way at the right time, is how Aristotle would put it. And then the third part is a discipline of the will. What do you do with the things that you don't control? What do you do in preparation of the difficulties that you might face in life? What do you do? How do you sort of come to terms with the finiteness of our own existence, that we're mortal people, right? That bad luck can strike us at any moment, you know? So these 3 disciplines, Marcus says, basically, this is all you need. If you can manage your perceptions, if you can direct your actions properly, if you can accept the things you can't change, that's all you need. Those 3 disciplines are basically the entirety of the philosophy, unless you want to, you know, sort of get really, really nerdy about it.
Right. How are the perception and will different?
Well, I think they're related, certainly, but it's one thing. Well, I'll give you an example. There's a concept in Stoicism. The phrase for it comes much later, but it's this idea of amor fati, which means a love of fate, sort of loving everything that happens to you. So it's one thing to see what happens to you objectively, right? Your plane is delayed. It's one thing to go like, okay, it's just a plane. It's just delayed. It's nothing I can do about it. And then it's another thing entirely to go, I'm glad that this happened, because I don't know what might have happened if this plane had taken off on time. Maybe it would have crashed. Maybe it would have been late in the air. Maybe now that I'm sitting at the airport, I have an opportunity to get some work done. Maybe I'll meet the person I'm going to spend the rest of my life with. You know, it's a chance for me to call my children and talk to them. It's a chance for me to get some exercise in, you know, whatever it is, right? So it's this, on the one hand, seeing things, that's sort of the first step, but then how are you going to integrate this thing that you don't change into your life? What's your attitude going to be about these things? That's the sort of next level. That's what the will is about.
Gotcha. So how specific, so using that example, is it enough to just try and change your perception? Is it enough to just try and love that your plane got delayed, or is there something, or are you looking for ways that that benefits you?
Well, it's both. It's certainly both. I think the first part is, the Stoics have this phrase they call it the art of acquiescence. That's accepting the things you can't change instead of fighting them. And then amor fati, I sort of put as like, that's like the next level, right? And I'm not saying that I'm in any way even capable of doing this, but the idea would be, okay, I'm not going to get upset by this. That's sort of, order number one. I'm not going to complain. I'm not going to think about all the ways I'm inconvenienced. I'm just going to accept that I'm not the pilot. I don't determine when the plane comes off. And then, sort of actively looking for the good in the situation, actively, and then I think making it good, the choices that you make in response to this, that's the next part. But look, these are not, it's not like a 1-2-3 process. These are sort of different lessons. They certainly overlap with each other. They're interrelated. It's just a way of making a distinction, I think, between the three different disciplines.
Right. Is there kind of a base, I don't want to say this, where does awareness, like self-awareness, fit into Stoic philosophy? Because even going back to this example, I think this, people are going to understand hearing this, that it's an easy concept to understand, but I think a lot of people lack that present moment awareness to actually be able to intervene in that thinking. They're just caught up in being angry or being upset. So where does awareness fit in?
It's right at the top. I mean, I think it's Epictetus. He's saying that, like, sort of the first step of philosophy is being able to question your own sort of your own mind, your own thoughts. And so that's what the Stoics are doing almost constantly. It's the questioning of one's own thoughts, one's own emotions, one's own impulses, which is the definition of self-awareness, not being jerked around by the voice in your head, being the one who is directing that voice in your head. So it's essential. Knowing why this is upsetting to you is the first step in sort of disassembling whether you really need to be upset about it.
How do you suggest people go about practicing this kind of from a macro and micro level?
Well, look, I think the first and easiest thing to do is just inserting a little bit of a pause. So many people just sort of go by their gut. They're always doing, right? They always feel like they have to be making shit happen. I think if you can put a little bit of a pause there, Viktor Frankl, wrote this wonderful book called Man's Search for Meaning. He's a survivor of the Holocaust. He's saying, in that pause is our opportunity between stimulus and response. He's saying is basically our opportunity to sort of direct our own destiny, to choose our own sort of life. And so if you can, yesterday I found myself getting really upset about something that happened, and I got so upset so quickly that I didn't really have, only in retrospect was it clear that I wasn't reacting to the thing I was reacting at. I was reacting to something else that I'd been putting off, that I made this thing about. And if I had been able to stop and go, why is this bothering me? What is this really about? I don't think that would have happened.
So at what point during that situation yesterday were you able to like see what was happening?
Let's say, I got up and I took a walk in the middle of it, and I came back, and then I was able not to be as upset anymore. And then as I talked through it, I got a little bit more clarity. Look, I don't think it's like, oh, and now that I tell you to put a pause in there, you're magically going to be able to never do this again. The point is, when I was, I'm 29, when I was 19, I probably wouldn't have been able to see this until like a year later. Right. And now maybe it's an hour later. And hopefully when I'm 40, it will be 30 minutes. And, hopefully I'm getting closer and closer to the source as I work on it, as I practice, as I see the results of it happening. And there are always going to be situations that are so look, a stoic gets in a car accident, they're going to get a dump of adrenaline. That's biological. This isn't some magical formula that lets you transcend your own biology or something, but it does let you override some of the destructive impulses and thoughts that we might have.
Mm-hmm. I think that's kind of a basic tenet of a lot of different philosophies or kind of spiritual frameworks. I think the Eastern, like Buddhists might call it the gap, right? And the point of meditation in general is first and foremost to increase the width of that gap.
Yes, absolutely.
So let's move on to one of your other books, The Ego is the Enemy. So first off, why is ego the enemy?
It's ego is the enemy, right? Which is a big distinction, because the ego is a sort of Freudian concept. It's a psychological construct. I'm talking about ego in the sort of colloquial sense, in the Donald Trump sense of the word, the Kanye West sense of the word, like the arrogance and delusion and selfishness and greed. You know, when a person's sort of self-importance grows so large that it begins to undermine the talent or strength that they have, that makes them who they are.
Totally understand. As opposed to the ego versus the id.
Yes, exactly.
Got it. So why is ego the enemy? And how does this compare to kind of the general notion of the very best in the world? And this is kind of this may just be a complete myth, right? So I'm just throwing out that a lot of people believe that to be the very best in the world, you have to be extremely confident. And some people will even say you have to be cocky, right? Say like Michael Jordan, he's notorious for being a very cocky person. So how do you compare the two?
Well, I make a big distinction between confidence and ego. I think ego is positive and has a lot of benefit. I think confidence is positive. I think confidence is earned. It's an understanding of your strengths and weaknesses. It's an understanding of the things you've accomplished and what you are bringing to a given situation. And I would say ego is that after it's turned sour, right? So look, if you don't believe you can do something, you're probably not going to be able to do it. Just because you believe you can do something does not mean you can do it. And so I make that distinction. I don't think Kanye West is a great rapper because he has a huge ego. I think he's a great rapper because he's a great rapper. I don't think Steve Jobs' ego is why the iPod was amazing. It's because he's a good product designer and he understands what people want and like. So that distinction, I think, is very important. And we often conflate the two, and we often confuse causation and correlation. When we see successful people who have big egos, we assume that one is responsible for the other, and it's likely not.
Right. So how does this fit in with athletes and high performers? How does ego get in the way?
Well, the more ambitious you are, the more likely it is that you're going to be struggling with the difference between confidence and ego, right? To think that, hey, I'm going to go out and be able to do this thing that very few people have ever been able to do, there is a little bit of ego, and there's also confidence in there. So my point is that, you know, for instance, to sit down and write a book is an extremely difficult thing to do, and most people are not able to do it. They quit halfway. They don't have what it takes. They don't have the determination, the stamina, whatever, or the skills. Confidence or ego, thinking that, you know, everything you make touches, or everything you turn touches to gold, everything you touch turns to gold, that you're the only one that knows what's good or not, you know, that anyone who disagrees with you is a hater, etc. These are also the things that would kill a book, or that would kill the potential of a book. So confidence is important on any ambitious project, but I think ego is dangerous.
Can you explain the canvas strategy that you talk about in your book?
Well, I'm talking about a strategy that I think is shouldn't be that revolutionary to people. But often when you're starting off in a field or in a situation, you know, you think like, oh, I'm so amazing, I've been chosen for this. They wouldn't have hired me at Google if I wasn't the best. But really, or you know, you get drafted, you know, they just did the NFL draft. You know, I just got chosen. Now I'm a professional football player. And it's like, no, you just went from being one of the best players in college to almost certainly one of the worst players in the NFL. And so if you don't come into that with a certain amount of humility and a willingness to learn, you're going to get your ass handed to you very quickly. So what I say you should do is you should attach yourself to someone who is really, really good, the person that you want to be. And you should apprentice under them. You should learn everything you can from them. You should dedicate yourself not to making yourself better, but to providing opportunities for them, to making them better. And in doing this, you're sort of subsuming your own ego into a cause larger than yourself. Bill Belichick, his first job is basically working for free for the Baltimore Colts. And he starts, you know, analyzing film. He gets really good at breaking this film down. And remember, the entire purpose of breaking down this film is to give it to other coaches who then take credit for the insights that he gave them. Mm-hmm. But this is the job. This is how you get ahead. It's how I got ahead. It's how I think almost all successful people learn the craft that they then become very good at.
So do you think that everyone should work towards, so I'm talking about this apprenticeship idea. Should they work towards having such a relationship that they have, you know, almost daily or weekly contact with this person, or is it monthly? How do you think about that?
Yeah, I don't think there's no rule. There's no like, look, you need to check in an hour a week. What matters is, are you growing from dealing with this person? You know, what is the process like? How are they pushing you to be better? That's what you're focused on. So it could be, you could be canvassing under someone you've never even been in the same room with. It doesn't really matter. What matters is it challenging you, and are you getting better and better?
Got it. So in Stoic philosophy, there seems to be a big emphasis on not worrying what others say or think about you, not worrying if you mm-hmm. If you get credit for things, as you were just talking about, et cetera, and that includes praise. So for you, you're 29 years old, and you are used in you're spoken in the same breath as Tim Ferriss all the time, and some of the world's like leading entrepreneurs. So I imagine that you get as much praise as many of these professional athletes and some actors and stuff like that. So my question is, what is your internal process for all of this? How do you take it, respond to it, and not let it negatively affect you?
Well, I don't think it's nearly as big of a sort of issue as you're talking about. Like it's not like I'm not drowning in so much praise that I can't help but let it go to my head, but I do get some, and I try not to think about it at all. I try to have sort of a distance between me and my work. So it's like, I know I worked really hard and I made this book, and I know it came from me, but I also sort of see it as something that's distinct from me and that I almost kind of don't know where it came from. So when someone is sort of lavishing praise on one of the books, it to me, it's a reflection of that piece of work and not a reflection of me. I think one of the dangers is when people's identities get wrapped up in their work, because then when people are saying that you're amazing, you feel great. But then when it's not going well, you feel that too. You know, Hemingway right. and Fitzgerald have this famous conversation where Hemingway says, basically, if you read the good reviews, you got to read the bad reviews too. The solution is just not to read any of the reviews, to have your own sort of set of standards, or have a much smaller group of people whose opinions matter to you. So I try to work on it that way.
So it sounds like you're saying like you being a great author, or someone listening to this being an amazing athlete, they can be that, but it doesn't mean you are worth more as a human being. Or if you're not doing well, it doesn't mean that you're worth less. Is that kind of what you're saying?
Yeah, look, if you watch most post-game interviews, you'll see athletes mention, you know, like, I want to thank God for this, or, you know, it was all, you know, like, glory to God, or thanks to God for this, or whatever. I'm not questioning their faith, but I would say part of that is just a coping mechanism with sort of professional athletics or any real difficult thing by making it seem like it's this sort of thing that's outside you, that there is a sort of a larger force involved, it also prevents some of that ego from creeping in. There's sort of just, it's that detachment from the work. When you win the championship, you're not going, oh, I'm so amazing. Look at how amazing I am. This is all me. You're trying to share some of that credit so it doesn't like go to your head.
Right. What other principles of Stoic philosophy do you think most directly relate to performance? And that includes any like habits or tactics such as negative visualization or self-denial.
Well, I think the negative visualization is a big one. You know, the Stoics were always trying to think not about the best case scenario, but the worst case scenario, not as an excuse to not do things, but as a way of preparing themselves for an outcome that might occur that's not in their control. So they were prepared for it. So they knew going in what might happen. I think that's a big one, certainly.
What's the actual process? Use that, and how do you teach that?
Yeah, look, like let's say I'm putting out a book. What I try to sit there and visualize is not, you know, the positive visualization is you on the New York Times bestseller list, you as the, you know, the glowing emails from the critics, you know, the sales numbers pouring in. I try to sit there and go, okay, what if there's a terrorist attack on the day it comes out and all the media gets canceled? What if the books don't arrive at the bookstores? What if everybody hates it because it's ahead of its time? Or, you know, and then I go, I'm going to be okay. I already have my next project. I knew this was a risk going in. I'm proud of the book. You know, I know that I did a good job. You know, so it's sort of walking through that. And then also, okay, what is something I could, like, let's say I'm worried that there could be something that could happen that could ruin my chances of getting lots of publicity. Well, I might also make plans so that my book is not solely dependent on getting publicity for sales. Right. Maybe this is why I built up a big email list. This is why I've, you know, been good at networking and develop relationships with people who can help, you know. So what proactive steps are you going to take to prevent this potential outcome from happening as well?
Love it. Anything else that you think directly relates to performance that you want to mention?
Well, the biggest one is making the distinction between what's in your control and what's outside your control, and then focusing exclusively on what is in your control. So, you know, let's say it's basketball. Once the shot leaves your hands, it's no longer in your control. So you don't kick yourself for taking the shot. You ask, you know, was I open? You know, was it a good shot? Did I practice the play the way that the coach had lined up? You know, and then am I ready to get the rebound, whatever happens, right? Or so you're focusing on the parts of it that you control and making that distinction, and then you're not kicking yourself or feeling guilty when something that's outside your control happens or doesn't happen.
Love it, man. There's a great example of this by one of the leading coaches in our community, Ben Bergeron. He got his four athletes together before the CrossFit Games last year and made a huge list of all of the things that could go wrong before mm-hmm. the actual CrossFit Games. And I think they came up with a list of over 100 different items. The girl that won, Katrin Davis-Sauter, she just felt very, very focused and was able to accept all of those things as they continue to come up throughout the weekend. So it's definitely being used. Yep. Let's see. I have some more personal type questions.
Okay.
How do you choose your friends? Do you choose people to spend your most time with that make you a better writer, entrepreneur? They make you a better person in general? People that you have fun with? How do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how consciously one chooses their friends, as part of some sort of professional or personal development, sort of regimen. But mm-hmm. I do think it's important that the people in your life are people who hold you to the standard that you would like to be held to, right? So these are people that inspire you. These are people who call you out on your bullshit. You know, these are people who, you know, motivate you to get out of your comfort zone. These are the things that I think about. I'm much more of an introverted person, so you know, I would be content sort of sitting alone doing my work. So when I am going out and doing things, I actually make a conscious decision to sort of spend time with people who are not going to talk to me about work. We're going to talk about totally unrelated things that are going to challenge me in ways that, you know, like, I don't need anyone to be motivating me to write more or work more or make more money. I'm pretty good in that regard. So I want to spend time with people who are not interested in those things, or they're not interested in them in the same way as me. My wife is very different than me. I'm very sort of ambitious and driven. She's much more in the moment. You know, she has much greater perspective on things. So these two things balance each other out. And I think that's an important element of these things.
So we talked before the show a little bit about your decision to buy a ranch. And yeah. I want to know about this, because this is something that my wife and I wrestle with a lot. Having grown up in a town of 5,000 people and really starting to get into Stoic philosophy more over the last few years, I feel really drawn to that type of lifestyle. Mm-hmm. And then there's another side of me that says I want to be around more people and the stuff. So I'm curious, you come from Sacramento, a very busy yeah. city. How did you decide to adopt that sort of lifestyle?
Well, it's funny. I guess if you grew up in a town of 5,000 people, Sacramento is a very busy city. It was, you know, it was considered like a cow town when I grew up
gotcha.
There. So
yeah, it's basically New York City to me.
Yeah, it's all relative. But you know, one of the things I think is interesting about the self-development, self-help space is like a lot of these decisions get sort of represented as part of these people's like lifestyle brands, or, you know, look, I was very conscious about where I decided to live, you know, so I lived in Southern California for a long time. Then when I wrote my first book, I moved to New Orleans. When I started to become successful as a writer, I felt like New York was the place to go. And then I wanted to go back to the South. So my wife and I sort of scoped out a bunch of cities, and we chose Austin. There's a bunch of things we liked about it sort of culturally. We had a lot of friends there, so we chose that. And then, you know, we said we want a little bit more space. So we started looking for like, you know, a couple acres, and that became, you know, the criteria got wider and wider, and we ended up with now about something about 40, and we, you know, we raise animals, and it's sort of a very different life. But it ended up having a lot of benefits. It's given me something to focus on besides, you know, sort of my job. It's peaceful. It gives you a lot of perspective. There's all sorts of great things. But it's not like something I would like, I'm not saying everyone needs to go move to a farm. It's like going to make your life better. What I think people should do instead is go, What does like a good day in my life look like? What do I want my life to look like? Like, for instance, like I take pictures of my animals all the time. Like, I'll take a picture of my goat or something, and we'll put it on Instagram, and people will be like, I've always wanted that, you know? And my answer, I'm always a little amazed by this, because like, it's not like this goat was like a Ferrari or something. It costs like $100 on Craigslist, right? It's something that literally anyone
could. You got a goat on Craigslist?
Yeah, I mean, where else are you gonna get it? you know, like it's not like it was some rigorous process for getting it. It's like getting a dog. People go like, I've always wanted a dog. Well, it's like, do you actually want a dog? If so, the path is pretty simple and well trod. Or do you just like saying you've always wanted a dog, but you actually aren't willing to do anything about it, right? So I think the point is, this is what worked for me. It was what I was interested in. I took a risk. It turned out to go well. People should figure that out for themselves.
Simple enough, man. Love it. So you seem to have a really narrow focus in your career, and I think I've heard you talk about it on a few occasions. I'm wondering, have you always been kind of just focused on a small amount of things, or have you deliberately narrowed your focus in your career And do you think that anyone that wants to be a high performer or master a skill should adopt that same mentality?
Well, I don't actually see myself as being that limited or focused. I mean, I feel like I have a fair amount of diversity. I'm working on a lot of projects at any one moment. But I do think I've gotten better over the years at saying no to the things that are not actually interesting to me. That's the hard part, right? So for instance, one of the things that happens with a lot of writers is like you'll write a book, it'll be successful, and then somebody wants to turn it into a TV show. And then the next thing you know, this person has moved to LA and they spend all this time, you know, trying to develop it. And most books never get turned into TV shows or movies. And it's like, they never stopped and asked, like, is that actually what I wanted? Because what happens is you get opportunities and then you evaluate the opportunity in isolation. Is this good? Is this not good? You don't say, is this getting me closer or further away from what I want? So that's something I think a lot about. It doesn't matter if the opportunity is how lucrative the opportunity is, unless you are doing it specifically to get money to do some other thing. But you should be asking, you know, is this getting me closer or further from, you know, what I want my life to be?
Gotcha. The ultimate vision or purpose.
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
So in general, I would say that you're absolutely crushing life. And you seem to be like really deeply involved in your own personal growth and the practicing of Stoic philosophy. You're also extremely productive in writing and business. Where does fun, joy, and excitement fit into your life? And are you deliberate about putting yourself into situations to experience those emotions and having fun?
Well, so first off, you know, you never know someone's crushing life because you don't know what they're trying to do. So this goes back to the ego discussion, right? It seems like some egotistical person is very successful, but maybe in their own eyes, they're extremely unsuccessful and they've been unable to crack something that they've been trying to do. I'm not saying that's true for me. I'm just saying you never know. And I think with me, a lot of the joy and pleasure and fun is inseparable from the work, right? Writing is really hard and there's at some points where you hate it, but I also wake up and get to do this crazy thing that I feel very lucky to be able to do. So that's a huge part of it for me. Like I spend very little time doing things that I don't want to do. And when I find myself doing things a lot that I don't want to do, I try to make changes in the structure of my business or my life that allows for that to change. And I would say on top of that, my career affords me the opportunity to do a lot of really fun things. Like to go to places that, you know, I don't remember the last time I had to travel. I traveled somewhere just for the hell of me traveling there. Because like my job takes me to all these places that I didn't even know I wanted to go. Mm-hmm. So there's lots of benefits to the job. But yeah, I try to spend... I try to think of things when opportunities come my way, and I try to go, is this something I'm going to be glad that I did, right? Like whether it's going somewhere or meeting someone or doing something, I'm always trying to sort of, experiment. I'm trying to introduce myself to new things. And then I'm also, again, trying to guide this against, for instance, skydiving seems like the least fucking fun thing in the world to me, right? Like I don't see any enjoyment in hurling myself out of a plane. But I think what happens is people go, oh, lots of people I know say it's awesome. They look at, you know, and so like I think one of the things that I try to live my life by is like knowing what I like and what I don't like and sort of trying to live accordingly rather than maybe doing what you're supposed to or what other people say is cool or whatever.
Makes perfect sense. Love it. So I noticed that you read a lot of history, not only philosophy, but other old texts.
Yeah.
Have you always been interested in those? And kind of what do you gain from reading old books?
Always been super interested in history. I mean, I think look, the reality is people have been documenting history, at least in the form of books, for say 5,000 years. And a lot of these are people who are much smarter than me, much more successful than me. There's a lot of hard-won wisdom in those books, and I'm trying to avail myself of that knowledge. I have a quote in Ego's the Enemy from Bismarck, where he's saying, you know, any fool can learn by experience. I prefer to learn by the experience of others. Ideally, you want to learn as many of the painful things not by experience as possible, because they're painful. Why would you want to learn painfully? So that's what I think the study of history presents to us, or at least that's one of the potential benefits. Plus, it's just interesting. It makes me a better writer, makes me a better conversationalist, you know, whatever.
Have you ever written a list of kind of your top books? Is that anywhere on the interwebs?
Yeah. On my website, I have a list. I call it Books to Base Your Life On. They're like the books that have been most influential to me as a reader. And then I document what I read every month. I send it out as an email, which you can sign up for on my site. It's at ryanholiday.net. But, you know, maybe 8 years ago, I started doing this, and it started with 100 people. Now it's about 80,000 people that get these recommendations once a month. I'm always looking for books that are going to challenge me and improve me, and then I try to share or pay forward what I learned.
Is it you that does the summaries of all of those books?
No, I don't do summaries. Okay. I just do like a little paragraph. This is what I liked about it. This is why I think it's worth reading. Blah blah blah.
Got it. Yeah, we'll link that in the show notes, guys. A few more to close out.
Okay.
Finish this sentence. If you really knew me, you'd know that.
That's a good question. I don't know. I'm always terrible at these rapid fire questions. I think I think when people know me, they tend to find that I actually don't like talking about myself. So interviews are always awkward for me. I prefer to sort of talk about whatever I'm interested in. I like really deep dive into certain topics or subjects. I like to be introspective about myself and my writing. I tend to find it uncomfortable in person. So I think that's something that I've picked up on.
What is something that you've changed your mind on in the last 6 to 12 months?
That is also a good question. In some ways, if you have one example on the top of your head, maybe you're not changing your mind enough. I'm sort of constantly trying to change my mind about things. I think politics has obviously been, you know, sort of controversial, and I was very convinced that Hillary Clinton wasn't gonna win the election. I was very shocked when she didn't. And I think sometimes being proven very wrong is always good, because it allows you to go, hey, I'm being way too certain in my opinions. Mm-hmm. There's not a specific. I didn't change my mind, you know, before it mattered. But it did change my mind again on, you know, the information that I'm consuming. How reliable is it? How certain am I able to be in these assumptions? Stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. With so many different options on how to stay up to date, where do you go for information on like current events, politics, et cetera?
Well, I think generally that's a game that's not worth winning. You know, unless you're a hedge fund manager, having your finger on the pulse of the news is a trap. I think you're much better to focus on perennial, timeless forms of information. You have better luck reading a book that was written 50 years ago that's still relevant, because it's still going to be relevant in 50 years, versus reading an article that came out 5 minutes ago that later this afternoon could be totally disproven.
That's a great answer. I like that. What do you want to make absurd in 20 years? And the example, there are a couple of examples I usually give to this question. 20 years ago, it was commonplace to see a grocery store clerk smoking a cigarette. Today, that's absurd. 20 years ago, it was common to see someone throwing an entire bag of trash out the window. And today, that's absurd. What do you want to make absurd?
I mean, as a writer, I think with philosophy, you know, the stereotype of a philosopher is a university professor or, you know, some pretentious grad student. And I think that's absurd. I hate that definition of philosophy. I think it's a perversion of what philosophy is supposed to be about. I think a philosopher is someone who lives the principles of philosophy, who leads a philosophical life. And I think in my writing, I've tried to tackle that.
I couldn't agree more, man. I absolutely think that you've already done that to thousands of people and thousands, millions more to come.
Thank you.
So for people that haven't gotten into any Stoic philosophy, haven't read any of your books, but they're athletes or coaches or other fitness enthusiasts, where's a good starting place?
So the obstacle is the way is my book that's become probably most popular with sports. If you're really specifically interested in philosophy, I think the Daily Stoic is one page of Stoic philosophy every day. It's a translated quote from one of the Stoics and then some analysis and context. I think it would be hard to do worse than either of those two.
Awesome, man. You have three of my 10 books in my office. You're on there three times.
Oh, so thank you. That says a lot. That's very cool.
So we have your website. Where else can people keep up with you? Do you use any social media regularly or what?
Yeah, I'm just at Ryan Holiday on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. So you can follow me there. Or you can sign up for my email list on my website.
Awesome, man. Anything else you want to leave these folks with?
No, I just keep reading. I don't care if you read my books. Just I think read books. There's a reason that almost every smart person in history was a lover of books. And I think it's an important tradition to follow.
Awesome, man. Thank you so much again.
Thanks for having me.